I'm Christopher Lighton. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation, we call it, with global attitude. This one is the third in a classroom series on torture, American style, at Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib. The writer Philip Gurevich turns one obvious response right around. After immersing himself in the awful record of Abu Ghraib, Philip Gurevich says, maybe the question to ask is not, how did we dehumanize them and do these things to them? But how did we do this to ourselves? In this third round on torture, we are again working with Professor James Dudarian in his class on global security at Brown University. There's no more admired and envied practitioner of journalism today than our guest Philip Gurevich, for his work on Rwanda, but for his work in The New Yorker and his editorship of the Great Paris Review. Philip's new book is called Standard Operating Procedure. We talked with Errol Morris, who made the movie of the same name, but the book is different. There's also a connection, too, though, with Philippe Sands and his book, Torture Team. We talked about it 2 days ago, including his argument that Abu Ghraib was really Guantanamo writ large, that there was a migration after the suspension of Geneva Conventions and the experience of interrogation at Guantanamo, a migration of all that stuff to Abu Ghraib. But let's plunge, Philip. How would you describe what you've tried to contribute to our understanding, our coming to terms, our contrition, our healing, our recovery from Abu Ghraib, and what more lies ahead?
Well, I don't think we're ready for contrition or healing particularly. I suppose a little contrition wouldn't be bad, but I don't think we're anywhere near putting this behind us. I think it's what's going on now. These are policies that remain completely in place and have gone from being clandestine to being official. The policy of systematically, physically abusing our prisoners in ways that either are torture or would have been torture a couple of years ago when people still thought that torture existed. The policy of the last 8 years has been to define torture out of existence, to say that torture involves deliberate infliction by documentable or provable intent of pain equivalent to the pain of death or of the loss of a major organ failure, which means just it's unknowable level of pain achieved by an undemonstrable and unprovable level of intent, which means it doesn't exist. You basically can never meet the bar of torture as it's been redefined by the administration lawyers. So having dismissed torture, anything that used to be called torture now gets rated as various degrees of what in international law is the next level, which is cruel, inhuman, and degrading punishment, which you might think sounds like the sort of thing you wouldn't want to be openly involved in either, but it's not actually codified in the United States criminal law as a crime in the same criminal sanctions, which means that the administration officials who are worried about their own culpability and so forth are much less concerned about being caught engaging in cruel, inhuman, and degrading behavior, even if it's identified as such. What really does this project of mine, what was I interested in about it? I was interested in several things. I actually started out with the idea that I wouldn't address the question of the administration's role at all. My initial understanding of the project was that I would look entirely inside the four walls of Abu Ghraib. The prison had nobody in it, when they took it over from Saddam. And by the end of November, the period when most of these pictures were taken was mid-October to mid-December, there were 6,000 or 7,000 people, most of whom had been rounded up in sweeps by U.S. forces who were sent out to help put down the unanticipated insurgency. And they would be sent with something like a GPS coordinate, being told, you know, there's a bad guy in this neighborhood named Abdul, and they'd go to the neighborhood and they'd ask for Abdul, and they'd just round up all the men, literally all the men over 14, boys and men. There were a lot of kids at Abu Ghraib. And they would bring them in trucks. And soldiers don't really like taking prisoners. Or they don't like holding prisoners. Soldiers who are war fighting, who are out in the actual combat zone, if they're told to take prisoners, all they want to know is, where do I dump them? I don't want to be holding them because they're a liability. They slow you down. They're a bad thing to be carrying. So they would just bring them all in, no questions asked. Round them up, bring them in, round them up. They had a lot of people that they called 50-meter detainees. They were within 50 meters of a suspected safe house or of an incident or of anything. They were on wrong place, wrong time was often written on the form as the reason for arrest. So there were lots and lots of innocent people who were held without charge in secret detention in what were essentially concentration camp conditions. The place was inside a combat zone, something that was mentioned but barely dealt with as a gross violation of any laws of war. And all of this was going on in this way that implicated much, much more than simply the chain of command, but the entire conception of how we were operating.
No question. Let me catch your breath one sec. On this matter of what's allowed, disallowed, encouraged, done, this strange mix of stuff, I should have read the further paragraph after the last one I read. Dugan, Tim Dugan, so he hears General Pappas say that Geneva Convention do not apply, and in your account, the story goes, Dugan thought that was pretty definitive. If the fucking Secretary of Defense designates the motherfucker an unlawful insurgency, I mean, what the fuck am I supposed to say? It's an unlawful insurgency, wouldn't you think? He's the second highest motherfucker in the country during the war, but he said, I was never told that I could physically abuse somebody. You weren't even allowed to threaten the use of physical violence.
He's a civilian interrogator. He was working for a company called Khaki Corporation. So he wasn't technically a military officer. But in the weird way that happens and continues to happen throughout this war, where we now have in Iraq more civilian contract people, both in the combat and non-combat roles, than we actually have American military personnel in Iraq, like the numbers 190,000 to 150,000, they had these guys who were hired. He'd been working as a security guard at like Walmarts and malls and things like that. And that was his interrogation background for the last 5 or 10 years. These guys would, he had military intelligence training. They would get hired through these corporations and then they'd be integrated into the military chain of command, though with dubious degrees of accountability.
So it's all mixed up. I want to get back to the matter of the policy of torture. You're quoting the famous Bybee, it's not torture up to the pain of death. Doctrine. It has never been repealed, so to speak. That memo has never been taken back. But the Supreme Court has ruled in the meantime that the Geneva Convention do apply. And surely the country has begun at least to realize that the whole world is up in arms about the violation of American standards here. You don't mean to say that nothing has changed, do you?
Yes, we've relaxed our laws. I mean, well, yeah, waterboarding has been legalized by the Congress.
Even Christopher Hitchens can do it now.
Both sides of the aisle. Our one public official who has survived torture, John McCain, and always stood against it out of political expedience and so as not to break party lines, voted for the decriminalization or legalization of waterboarding, a practice that was called torture certainly when he was subjected to that sort of thing and always has been since and certainly would be by any single one of these politicians had they seen it done to an American soldier. That was not the case even then. The very fact that we have debates in this country about whether or not, you know, torture is allowed, legitimate, efficacious, you know, the ticking time bomb scenario, that you have Harvard professors and law professors and so forth coming out and saying, well, you know, there are times when it's necessary and it's not a bad idea. This really is the same as us saying, you know, there are certain people who it's actually utilitarian for the society to exterminate. We know it's an unattractive subject, but let's be reasonable. Let's be lucid, all of us, and talk about these things. It's not considered done. We don't talk – this is a huge erosion from where we were 20, 25 years ago. One didn't have this conversation. Right now what you have is far from the after – the lesson of Abu Ghraib is that you can do this stuff and get away with it. That's the lesson of it. That, much like the lesson of the Rwandan genocide, frankly, is that, you know, there's very little price to pay
surely,
for these things.
Surely that's not the final lesson. Even listening to the troops who did it and their nightmares and their broken lives since then is one piece of testimony that the crime will out.
The crime will out. The shame will be there, but I'm talking about the political consequences of it, certainly in our time. And right now, the mood remains for torture. The desire to vilify these lowest-ranking soldiers, to pin on them as kinky perverts who, like, messed around on the night shift and had their sexual fantasies played out through some sort of S&M photographs and treat them as the bad apples. And to simply say that they couldn't have had anything to do with who we are and what we stand for in a war that we obviously went to fight in the name of stopping such things. We needed to believe that they weren't us. They did not represent our policy. That was convenient for left, right, and center in the country. Everybody agreed that was not something that we were ready to own up to and to live up to. Nobody wanted to look at those photographs and say, yeah, that's what we're doing and that's what we do. Why did those photographs come out in April of 2004 and there was never mention of them in the debates about the war that were supposed to shape the campaign? The president, who was responsible for those policies that led to those torture and those images, is this the image of ourselves and is this the way that we want to project our force into the world? That question never arose. Frankly, I think it's because it wasn't a very popular question. I don't think most of us were ready to say, I don't understand why, but we have polls now. There's a poll, it's mostly about Christian evangelicals, but it says that 65 or 70% of Christian evangelicals think that torture is perfectly okay under certain circumstances. Under certain circumstances means if it's your enemy being tortured or your perceived enemy. The fact that we were torturing innocent people seems to me to be significant, and so that it kind of counteracts the ticking time bomb fantasy that most pro-torture people bandy about. And the other thing that's really telling is when you talk to these guys who were involved, not a single piece of important actionable intelligence came out of Abu Ghraib. The whole reason for this whole operation was allegedly to acquire actionable intelligence, and yet nobody has repudiated this method. Nobody has said, we must never do these things anymore. Not nobody. Obviously, people have, but they're mostly considered woolly long hairs and journalists and various other subversives, and it's not what you hear in Congress. It's not what you hear from our alleged opposition party in Congress. We don't have one. The country is united in its acceptance of this behavior. I have never seen a protest of any significance. I have never seen students get up and march and say, not in my name. I have never seen any such behavior. I think that people are basically comfortable with it, and they basically think they blew up our building. What the soldiers themselves say, they blew up our buildings, to hell with them. I'm afraid that that is the state we're at right now. And it's part of what I found really discouraging about writing about this stuff. I would like to be able to say the country found that it's a dark element within it found brief expression and was snuffed. That would be marvelous. it would hearten me greatly. And I don't think that in the long run it can't be snuffed. I'm not saying this is who we are and America's twisted or something. Far from it. My attempt to grapple with this stuff is out of a kind of pure patriotism, frankly. It's the idea that this is us going astray. But we have not yet gotten ourselves unastray, whatever that word would be.
Philippe Sands says that if we don't deal with it, the world will. You know, perhaps with a citizen arrest of Donald Rumsfeld as he's walking down the main street in Geneva someday.
I think he can live without going there. It's not going to cramp Donald Rumsfeld's style not to walk around Philippe Sands' backyard. And I just don't think he's going to do it.
One last step. Countries do pay individually and collectively. The French paid for their torture in Algeria. The British, in a fashion, have paid for their cruelty in Northern Ireland, too. And things do change. Countries eventually do reckon with these things. What are we to do with this history?
Well, it's not history is what I'm trying to say. I'm not trying to give a big cynical rant here. I'm just simply trying to say it's not history. It's our present. It is where we are. It is before us, right? And as well as a few years ago. And I think one way that one gets past it is that one recriminalizes torture. That can be done legally. One can actually create a set of orders and commands where one reasserts certain aspects of American doctrine, military doctrine, because people talk about the Geneva Convention and often you sort of get this feeling that the Geneva Convention is foreign and imported and Genevan. And in fact, it's U.S. military doctrine. And in fact, if you study the U.S. military doctrine on the treatment of detainees in wartime, it specifically subordinates itself to the Geneva Convention. It says not only does it embrace it and say basically the Geneva Convention is our doctrine, it says should there be any discrepancy between what is laid out in American military doctrine's language and the Geneva Convention should prevail, which is extraordinary and tells you that that's what everybody's been trained in for 50 years. That training can be reasserted. There are a lot. The people who I've heard from who are the most indignant when they read this book are not, you know, your average Obama button wearing citizen, but military people.
Yes.
JAGs, military lawyers, who say this is just outrageous. This stuff goes to the top. These poor kids were framed. This stuff has to be reasserted. These are commands that are given, and they're commands that can be taken away, and new commands can be given. We have to assert that. We have to establish as a matter of principle that this is the highest value of this country, is that we won't do this, and that we cannot win whatever this fight is about by doing it this way. And that's very important because, in fact, America actually has a tradition that goes way, way back to the Revolutionary War of treating prisoners better than our adversaries. Whereas here our argument is, oh, we're going to treat prisoners badly because they would treat us badly. You know, and you hear this from these soldiers. Well, they would have lopped our heads off. Oh, well, so you're being nice to them by only hanging them from a cage and sicking a dog on them. You know, they got their heads still. And you know, the argument was, yes, they're going to lop our heads off, and we are going to treat them with the rights and respects that are afforded to an enemy combatant once they have been neutralized and pose no physical threat to us. It doesn't mean that we're going to treat them with love. It doesn't mean that we're going to treat them as innocent of offenses. But one treats them according to these kinds of principles. And in a war on terror, whatever broadly this shapeless war is, it's also a war for global public opinion. And it has been from the start. And it has failed to be – the failure to wage it that way is most directly exemplified by this policy of torture. And the price that you talk about the French paying after Algeria or the British after Ireland, that price is a political price. It's not that this or that French guy with pliers and tongs got sent to jail. It's that the – broadly speaking, France as a nation was humiliated for humiliating its enemies. As a matter of policy, France as a nation lost its authority in an area that it lost its power, it lost its authority, it was restricted, it shrank back within its borders militarily. And I think that America cannot prevail in its kind of projection of its ideas and its force if it continues to project complete antithesis of these ideals. That's where the reckoning's got to happen.
James Dedarian, how about Philip Gurevich from your side?
Well, I actually agree. I don't think Rumsfeld's going to do a perp walk anytime soon. Or the lawyers involved in particular, they have a knack of staying out of jail. I'm thinking about Gonzalez, you know, Haynes, who in some ways were more culpable than Rumsfeld, I think, for enabling this. That said, I have to ask an NPR question. Even though Chris used the MF word 7 times and we're not at all like NPR, I have this Terry Gross question. If it wasn't to get justice, if it wasn't to get those people behind bars, if it wasn't to deter the future actions, why did you write the book?
Oh, because you can't even begin to think about these things until you know a certain amount of information about them. And to make a record seems to me to be a worthwhile end in itself. And if one depended only on lawyers to sort of fulfill one's purposes in the world, there'd be no literature. There wouldn't be much in the way of journalism, and there wouldn't be much in the way of knowledge. Because my interest is in trying to say, you know, maybe the lawyers will succeed or maybe they'll fail. But we need to know how these things happened, and also to record the voices of these people who are actually there. And there's a whole other side to this, which is when you read about these kids, the easiest thing, as I said earlier, is to distance yourself from them. Is to think like I would never be like that. They are rogue soldiers. They are people without any sense of themselves. They are people. They're base. They're degraded as well as degrading. They have no moral compass. And one reassures oneself. Frankly, most of the literature that we have about atrocity and so forth that does reasonably well, and most of the popular films are films in which either vigilantism is celebrated or a certain kind of righteous person who is the whistleblower, the resistor, the person who, you know, the Schindler. Right, and we're supposed to be able to watch this movie about the Holocaust by thinking, well, if I had to be a Nazi, at least I'd be that kind of Nazi. You know, it used to be that you got to watch movies where you were told, like, I wouldn't even be a Nazi. Now you think, well, you know, Nazi not so bad. You could always be Schindler. You know, and look how much they loved him. And of course, it's not true. most people would actually be just so-called ordinary Germans who did not acquit themselves elegantly. What the history of the world tells us is that the great mass of people behaves horribly when put to the test. Mm-hmm. And what you see when you see this story is, you know, we all like, I mean, Primo Levi talked about this. He talked about going around towards the end of his life and speaking in Italian schools and having these kids kind of ask questions like, well, okay, so where was the guard tower at Auschwitz and where was the wall and where were the fences? And so, okay, what you should have done to escape is, and it would depress him endlessly because it meant that he had totally failed to explain what total meant. What total meant. And what you realize when you – that's why I talked about the claustrophobia and the four walls at Abu Ghraib. These kids were sent there without any training. They were sent there more or less to do what soldiers do, which is to obey what they're told to do and to go along with what their what the explicit and implicit environment that they're placed in is. And they are told to suspend a great deal of their judgment. And they are told to entrust that judgment to their immediate superiors, who in turn are told to entrust it to their superiors, so that it's a very corruptible system. What is supposed to be a system of command responsibility, where each officer disciplines those below him, because if they are out of line, that becomes a mark against him as well, to his superiors. Then what happens is instead you think, look, I know you're screwing up, but I'm not going to tell my commander because then I'm screwing up. We're going to erase this problem, and it sort of becomes omerta. And what I was interested in is that's how the whole country, I'm afraid, has worked to a certain degree. We have all assured ourselves that we are not like them, rather than seeing the extent to which, unfortunately, we've kind of made our peace with it.
Well, the containment of public outrage is an issue that I think, not because people aren't reading Primo Levi, but it's because they're watching Jack Bauer. You know, popular culture in some ways sanctions this as much as, you know, all the other factors you've given. I mean, the idea of Jack Bauer in 24, the ticking time bomb, seems to be prevalent, I mean, as a justification.
Yeah, well, there's a deep strain in American culture of that, of sort of take it into your own hands and go ahead and do it. And there's a deep strain of a kind of tough, humanist cowboy justice as well, which is very different. There's the image of us as, you know, the American GI walking up into the hills of Italy and handing out the bonbons to the kids who've been freed from fascism. And that's not a lie. These are two, and it's not even a lie in Iraq. I mean, the interesting thing is Charles Grainer, whom we have, who was the MP in charge of the night shift at Abu Ghraib and took many of the photographs and is seen as the sort of chief sadist of this whole episode, when he kind of needed to unwind after a night, he'd go along with this guy, Ken Davis, whom I have a couple of chapters about, who ran convoys. And he would just say, can I ride along with you? You need an extra gunner. You need somebody. And when Ken Davis's job was taking Iraqi prisoners to Iraqi courts, there weren't many working Iraqi courts, but he'd take them there for their court hearings. And he would always take the time to go and hand out biblical tracts and teddy bears and sweets to people around there. This is what Charles Grainer liked to do. He had a reputation for it, at least as much of the time that more people knew him for that than for other things. Sabrina Harmon, who took the great majority of the photographs that have become iconic and that we know about, she was called Mother Teresa in their previous posting. None of these people had prior records in the army of being some kind of like special sadists. They had actually had a really good record. They'd been in a town called Al-Hilla near ancient Babylon for the first 3-4 months that they were in Iraq, just before they got transferred to Abu Ghraib. And that was a town where you could actually walk around without getting shot. And they made friends with Iraqis. She did not have money in any, you know, personal sense. She used what money she had to buy a refrigerator for a family, stock it with food. She was always giving stuff to kids. This was kind of, she was about as close to being a poster child for the way the war was being sold by the administration's sort of rosiest propaganda, as she became a poster child for everything that was most perverse and amok about the war. So this kind of, I think that in a kind of partisan political conflicted moment, we have this desire to divide these things and sort of say, bad guy, good guy, you know, rather than kind of seeing how this is all tangled up in there together, and particularly amongst those, you know, who still, like Tennyson said, it's not theirs to wonder why, theirs to do and die.
Well, can I push this a little further? What's the enabling factors, if there is a torture within all of us that just dying to come out?
I don't know about that. I guess what I think is that there's one doesn't know until one's tested, and I suppose the best one can hope for the world is that one works towards a world where there are the fewest possible scenarios in which one is tested.
I'd love you to read a short passage, Philip, because the words are more powerful for me than the pictures. This is of the dogs and prisoner called A.Q. Beginning here, it's the account of a man named Frederick.
Okay, yeah, this is an account basically based on testimony of Sergeant Frederick, who was – he was actually Grainer's immediate superior. He was in charge of the whole section of the prison on the night shift. And there was a prisoner named A.Q., as in Al-Qaeda, who had been picked up and brought to the prison. And Donald Rumsfeld was monitoring his treatment very closely. And he was he was one of the prisoners in December who appeared in the photographs we've seen of the dogs being sicked on these prisoners, a kind of behavior that he called the doggy dance. It was hard to capture the doggy dance on camera. The men and the dogs jigging about kept getting in the way of the shot. But on December 30, Megan Ambule did it with a set of pictures of Michael Smith, one of the dog handlers, and his dog confronting a prisoner who was known as AQ because he was believed to be an Al-Qaeda operative. AQ was considered the prize prisoner on the block at that time. The Secretary of Defense was said to have a particular interest in him and to check in with Colonel Pappas several times a week by phone or video conference for updates on his interrogation. Big Steve, one of the civilian contractors, was AQ's handler, and according to Sergeant Frederick, he said, "Put the dogs on AQ every chance we got, to use the dogs to bark at him, scare him, intimidate him. He just basically wanted to use the dogs on him to treat him like shit. He would tell us to put AQ in this position or that position, then put the dogs on him. Then he would tell them to pull the dogs off. Then he would go in the cell, shut the door, and I guess interrogate him." On the night of the photographs, AQ was laid on his side on the floor with his hands tied behind his back, and Smith let his dog bark in his face from no more than a foot or two away. Then AQ was hoisted into a kneeling position with his back to a wall, and a sandbag was placed over his bowed head. Once again, Smith moved in with the animal. In one picture, you see it lunging, ears back, a black blur of muscle and jaw aimed straight at the top of the sandbag. In the next picture, you see AQ bareheaded. The dog has nipped the sandbag off, and the prisoner is trying to flatten himself against the wall, which is difficult to do when you're on your knees with your hands tied over your tailbone. The movement thrusts your chest toward the avid dog, barking just inches from your throat, and this time Smith is in the picture, crouching over the dog, restraining him and urging him on at the same time. It does not seem possible to amplify the drama of this moment, but the look on AQ's face does just that. He has the horrified, drawn back, and quivering expression of a thoroughly blasted soul. It is all there in his eyes, moist and mad with fear, fixed on a mouthful of fangs. What secrets does he have that we want so badly but are so precious to him that he endures this day after day? The answer in AQ's case was none. Once again at Abu Ghraib they had the wrong guy, or they had the guy wrong, and when they realized this after several months of dogs and bondage and hooding and noise and sleeplessness and heat and cold and who knows just what other robust counter-resistance techniques, they told him to scram and closed his case. The pictures of AQ on that night before New Year's Eve are the last known photographs of our prisoners on the MI block at Abu Ghraib, which seems fitting, because these pictures don't leave much to the viewer's imagination, except the obvious question. If you fight terror with terror, how can you tell which is which?
Thank you.
It's hard to have a follow-up question after that, but just one last question. How do you reach the level of dehumanization that makes this possible? I mean, what's the role of culture? How do you treat the other? How do you get to that stage where the person's no longer a person, just an object to which you can inflict this kind of bodily harm and humiliation?
I think that turns out to be fairly easy. It just seems to be. I mean, if you look at a lot of throughout history and throughout all sorts of places, it turns out to be. Now, in this specific case here, the fact that you are recruiting people sort of with this notion that, like, they blew up our buildings and we're going to go get the terrorists and that these are the worst of the worst. You are being given a crucial mission to this war. This is the military intelligence block. And then they had people come in, the military intelligence handlers, these guys like Big Steve and others, and they were told, you know, keep them up at night, do these things. And I talk a lot about how these soldiers were told to do things that shocked them at first. But as Sabrina Harmon at one point says, you know, the first night you come in and you see a guy you know, chained naked to the side of his cage, and you think, wow, that's crazy, that's bad. And the next day you come in and you see some guy, you know, chained upside down and with panties on his head and people jeering at him and dogs barking, and you think, well, I guess that guy yesterday didn't have it so bad. And they keep being told these guys are bad and what you're doing is good. You're helping us break them. That was good last night. We got more out of them. Whatever that means, since no actionable intelligence came. There also were affiliated with Abu Ghraib and with the whole war mission, psychiatrists and anthropologists of a particularly bogus brand, as far as I can tell. But, I mean, all proper degrees from the proper schools, which guarantee nothing. But they worked writing these papers, like the Arab mind. According to this diagnosis of the Arab mind is one in which males have a tremendous aversion to being stripped naked and paraded in front of their captors. They find this humiliating and degrading, as opposed to, as you know, the Western mind, which pays extra. I mean, really. And they would say, there's an Arab fear of dogs. It was actually described. The technique was not dogs. It was exploiting the Arab fear of dogs. Now, there seems to be some cultural truth that, you know, we all know that in some cultures, people like build separate beds and fetishize their dogs, and Lenora Helmsley, or whatever her name is, leaves $6 million to the care and feeding of her mutts. But, you know, and in other cultures, you always keep them in the backyard and you throw them scraps and you say scram and they don't like them. Okay, but nobody likes having Belgian shepherds lunging at their naked genitals while they're chained to a wall and seven people are chasing them down. The idea, women, of course, were used in all of this as sort of force multipliers. I mean, that's how they spoke of dogs, as force multipliers. Well, women were used as force multipliers as well, in the sense that they were supposed to stand around and just jeer. You know, if a guy was stripped naked, they'd sort of point at him and jeer. Now, very little has been said in any question of accountability of why we are actually humiliating and violating American women by making them stand around in these positions, which seems to me to be part of it too. Like, this is an abuse of our women soldiers, as well as using them as instruments of abuse against these Arab men. But a lot of that stuff was built into it. So there was this kind of, and it's interesting because I don't think it's specifically, I mean, it takes on a racialist element, but it wasn't really like racism in any particularly predisposed way, because they also were working alongside Iraqi guys, who some of them they got along with and some of them they distrusted. They had not been racist at all, in, as far as I can tell, in Al-Hilla. What you got was a specific idea of, like, these are the terrorists, these are the bad guys. In their culture, they don't believe in you. You know, these are the Islamic fundamentalists. Islam says that you must be annihilated. You know, and so it's pretty easy if you sort of say they would dehumanize you, they would cut your head off. It's very easy to dehumanize people. It's very easy to sort of say they're forfeited their right. And that's, I mean, that happens in any police station in the country if things get out of hand, that you could have somebody sort of saying, like, this guy's kind of forfeited his right to, like, fair treatment. Plus, you cuff it out of him. You know, you knock him around a little bit. You soften him up. You make an example of him. All of that has a kind of logic to it, especially when the people who objected were told to shut up. People who had a question about it were basically told, this is how it goes. And, you know, my favorite story is about this one guy, Matthew Wisdom, my favorite story of whistleblowing, who has sometimes been celebrated as a sort of whistleblower, because on the night of the pyramid, he was an MP who walked onto the tier and saw this going on and was very disturbed by it and went and told his commander about it. And his commander decided to move him from – he said, I don't want to serve in this part of the prison. Now, many people say, I said that and nobody listened to me, but they put him on the guard towers. Well, within a month, the people who were on guard duty on the guard towers were using live ammunition to shoot at non-military intelligence holds, prisoners who we know had no charges against them, being held in outdoor camps, shooting at them with live ammunition because they were protesting having glass in their food and being fed during the day in Ramadan. Mm-hmm. So when you've got American soldiers, these are the guys who weren't doing anything wrong, who are shooting prisoners with live ammunition as a matter of course, and that's your relief from having to be a torturer, I'm not sure that the thing's working.
Why don't we open it up? I hope you're not too numbed, shocked, depressed by this to have a question for our guest.
Hi, my name is Nisha Shah. I have a question about... Well, I think in what you said today, there are two stories. There's a question about the legitimation of torture against known enemies, people we know who are terrorists or have committed acts of violence. And then you said there's the legitimation of torture against innocent people. And how does that second category of legitimation occur, in your opinion?
Well, in there is the legitimation of torture against people classified as known terrorists. Or, I mean, they're not really known to be terrorists. AQ was our most known terrorist prisoner at that point when he in that scene that I just read. And then everybody was like, oh, he was just actually – he really was – that wasn't a cover story. He really was importing used cars from Yemen, you know. And they just, like, scrambled him out the door. Sorry for those months. And so those categories are actually – pretty mixed, and most of the people who were known to be – who we know are innocent were not seen as innocent there. I mean, the idea is once you're in prison, you're not innocent. Never mind that there was no system of release, that there was no system of courts, that there was no system of justice in place. So the legitimation of torture against innocent people is kind of the idea, broadly speaking, that it's war and, as Rumsfeld put it, stuff happens. You know, it's war. And one of the questions I have sometimes got is, you know, isn't this just the kind of thing that often happens in war? And to some extent, the answer is yes. But that's, again, goes back to the idea that there is a long American tradition of really making a considerable effort. And I'm not saying that America hasn't broken its own principles before, but it's never made it a principle to break those principles. It's never tried to take what Cheney calls the dark side and make it the light side, make it standard operating procedure. I mean, if we had some dirty guy go do dirty tricks on somebody before, the understanding was it was clandestine and it was dirty and it was illegal. And now these kids, these are not kids who knew that they were in a black operation. They hadn't been read in to some secret operation. These were not trained people. These were the very fact that we expected ordinary reservist soldiers who were basically weekend warriors who were doing this out of a kind of like get a scholarship and move on through life with a little bit of army background, that we were entrusting this to them shows what a slovenly operation it was on one level, but also how kind of out in the open it was.
Can I ask you the Al Jazeera question? I mean, awful things happen in every war, but we don't go to war with everybody. How do we escape the feeling, reading your book again, that these were outrages that would never be considered against white Europeans? I don't think they'd be considered against black Africans either. Can you imagine this kind of both warfare and imprisonment torture being inflicted against any other slice of the human family in this world today? I can't.
Yeah, sure. Really? I mean, we did it to a John Walker Lind because he was with them. We did it to these Australian guys who got sent to Guantanamo and the Brits. Sure. If you're on the wrong side, you know, you're on the wrong side, my friend. You know? And I think at this point, the fact that right now that there's a religious, cultural war element involved, but there often is when you get to a big war, you know? Even if you want to put it in culture war terms or a war of our principles versus theirs or like our civilization versus theirs, we've violated the principles that we claim our civilization stands for in order to fight off this threat to our civilization. That's what's so incoherent about it. That's where when I look at those photographs from Abu Ghraib, when I look at the story, a lot of what I wrote this book for is to ask not like why did we go and how did we dehumanize and do these things to them? How did we do this to ourselves? Why are we doing this to ourselves? You know? Maybe the best way to get us to stop doing it is not to ask why are we doing this to them. Why are we doing this to ourselves? And I think that's an important question.
That's good. That's great.
David Kim from the Koch Center for the Humanities here in Connecticut College. That actually was my question about, I mean, if it's so, it was so easy to dehumanize ourselves as well as the enemy, you know, what resources, what recourse do we have to rehumanize? You know, what possibility? I mean, it seems like such a steep slope to get back.
Early in the book, I start the book with these two characters, two men, who were each, as it happened, had served as commissioners of corrections in the state of Utah in their careers. And they had been tapped in the sort of immediate end of the war, May 2003, fall of Baghdad. They both got calls from a Justice Department, then Ashcroft's Justice Department, though, as we're increasingly finding out, for all that upset us about his behavior on the domestic scene, he was actually probably one of the more restrained figures in the administration's War on Terror cabinet. interestingly. And he, this had nothing to do with that. He basically was putting together a team. There's a stand, anybody who's dealt with post-conflict situations around the world knows that there's like a standing team at the Justice Department that goes out and does courts and prison, not prisons, courts and cops. You know, when Bratton from New York or so, before he went to L.A., would go down to Haiti and train cops. Or we'd send people into Bosnia to train up cops afterwards. Teach people who had been living in a political system where there was no sort of proper law and order, and the law and order was the instrument of a totalitarian or authoritarian abusive state, how to run a proper police force. And these were very successful programs run through the Justice Department. And they decided this time to add an element, which was prisons. The idea was Saddam Hussein had used these prisons as the whole system of control, and there, in order to build the new Iraq that we were there to do, and that we had waged this war to do, and as liberators, we needed to prepare a whole plan for rebuilding a criminal justice system, cops, courts, and corrections in Iraq. And these two guys were sent over as part of what was then a four-man assessment team that, by the time it hit the ground, like 48 hours later, became a four-man implementation team to sort of get prisons up and running. Now, Saddam had emptied his prisons the fall before. In October 2003, which is where the book really starts, he had actually released all the prisoners as some kind of mysterious – it was a little bit like the boat lift from Cuba. You know, it was like it's some kind of munificent gesture that work plays one way at home and plays a different way abroad, and it was very complicated. A little mise-en-scene of his there. But he got it out. There are all these gutted, looted prisons. The Americans come in. And, you know, they start setting up these prisons with the idea that they're going to teach people how to operate proper prisons, and then the military takes them over and it becomes Abu Ghraib. But I got interested in one of these guys, Lane McCotter, who's the senior of the two prison commission guys. And I started studying his resume, which, like, is 7 or 8 or 9 pages long. He'd been at Long Binh Jail in Vietnam after the race riot that destroyed that prison on Labor Day of 1968 when black American soldiers rioted in a huge uprising that burned the stockade to the ground in there. And he had been there rebuilding that. He had worked in, like, every branch of the Army. He'd run Fort Leavenworth, the only maximum security military prison. He'd taken over the Texas prisons as commissioner. He'd taken over the New Mexico prisons as commissioner. And he finally ended up in Utah, where a guy died in a restraining chair on his watch, ended his career, and he went into private prisons. Let me read you a tiny passage. This is just – and then I'll loop all the way back around to why I'm answering the question this way. From when he was in prison – when he was in Texas. McCotter called Texas his third tour of combat. In 1980, a federal court had found the state's prisons to be so comprehensively barbarous that the entire Texas system was declared unconstitutional. It is impossible, Judge William Wayne Justice wrote, to convey the pernicious conditions and the pain and degradation which ordinary inmates suffer within TDC prison walls. Judge Justice went on to enumerate the terrors, the rape and murder of inmates by inmates, the cruel, at times suffocating overcrowding on the one hand, and on the other hand, the arbitrary and abusive administration of solitary confinement, the incessant physical discomfort and psychological stress of prisoners preyed upon by prison gangs and by guards, the bitter helplessness of inmates at being prevented from seeking legal relief from these injustices. And McCotter went in as a reformer at that point. And I brought this up and I kind of inserted it there at the beginning when I'm introducing this guy to remind us, like, who do we think we are exporting prisons? What do we're like, you know, you're saying, oh, look, this is how we treat Arabs. This is how we treat people in prison some of the time when we go astray. Other times we have a guy come in and we start to correct it. The prisons in Texas were under federal receivership for over a decade. They're not so great now. Angola Prison, which has been cleaned up in Louisiana, was a pretty rough place for a very long time. These American prisons, you know, we assume that it's okay in this country to throw somebody in prison and that that rape is part of their punishment. It's a crime outside of prison. But to be raped by your fellow prisoner is basically almost never punished, and it's quite widespread. These sorts of things. So when we talk about how easy it is for us to dehumanize, I think we also ought to remember that it's not something strange that happens abroad. It's something that takes place in certain kinds of institutions when they are not super strictly controlled. And the whole idea of a military is to take young people and harness their violence and use it for a utilitarian end. And that's why military discipline is everything. You know, it is a kind of virtue if it is used really, really well, and it can create remarkable men and women. And it is a tremendous failure of the system and abuse of the whole society that generated that army when that discipline is not just – it's too simple to call it a breakdown of discipline at Abu Ghraib. When that discipline is used deviously and against its principles, and that's what we saw there. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if I answered your question or –
Yep. What? No, another question.
It's Lawrence Goodman. You sort of alluded to this earlier that in Vietnam there were certainly many instances where American troops treated prisoners brutally. And even if there was a tradition in this country of treating prisoners better than they might have treated us, there's still many instances of savagery throughout the country's history. I guess what I'm asking in a strange way is, can you make the argument that we are becoming less inhumane? Maybe not humane, but if you look at the way warfare is being waged, we are in some way less barbaric than we were even 20, 30 years ago?
Sure. I mean, you could certainly make the case that it's just like limp-wristed and silly to worry about this stuff at Abu Ghraib. Nobody got hurt. I mean, a few people died, but nobody like, you know, it wasn't like we were cutting people to pieces or stretching them on racks and tearing their bodies forever. Most of them, they're a little traumatized, you know. You could make that kind of a case, that this kind of behavior is only shocking on a scale where we've gotten over a lot more shocking behavior, which is sort of the argument like, well, hey, we're not cutting their heads off, right? So there's certainly that argument. We're less barbarous than the guys who are cutting their heads off. There's also the argument that this stuff has always happened, but how to put it? The big offense of the war on terror is generally described as waterboarding. That's sort of like often held up as a kind of technique that is particularly clearly torture that is used in practice. In Vietnam, they had the half a helicopter ride. You take a guy up in a helicopter and you push him out, and he dies. Nobody in Congress ever tried to defend it. Nobody in Congress ever tried to say we should make that our practice, that these times demand half helicopter rides, where people would start to journalists like Christopher Hitchens would go and like take a half a helicopter ride to see what it felt like, you know. And you have all these anchor people strapping themselves into like tortured things to decide if it's torture. It's absurd. And so you know, in Michael Hare's Dispatches, there's a scene where the journalists are sitting around in a fire base out in the field. And a prisoner's brought in, and they're basically told, you don't want to see this. Get out of here now. Now, you could say, well, those journalists were complicit. You could say that with a good cause. And you wonder to what extent that even goes on with embeds and so forth now. But the big, big difference is not a question of whether we're becoming more or less barbarous, which I think there is an argument that we are becoming, that the standards of barbarism are you know, you no longer have to kill all the firstborn and you no longer have to rape all the women in the village. But that the standard of barbarism in that sense is the bar is lower. But the problem to me is the legal legitimation of it and the decriminalization of it and the defense of it as a legitimate position for a public officials to take and for it to become a common – I think it's barbaric that we have distinguished professors around the country who make a living off defending torture. How is that not a slide back towards barbarism? You know? What about infanticide? There are arguments for it. You know? Depends on the infant, perhaps, but that's part of the discussion we should be having. I mean, it's absurdism is what I'm saying. I mean, this used to belong to the theater of the absurd. That you'd have you know, sort of law professors getting up and saying, well, a legal opinion could exempt the president from any accountability for giving the order to do this because we're in a time of war. And what you also had in this whole legal reasoning, and I think it's important to understand that, is there were two sides here. There were people who really wanted to be able to kick ass and who really wanted that, but they also really wanted to advance a theory of the unlimited executive power. Of wartime executive powers where a president simply was totally unchecked by the law. And these two things converged in our torture policy. These two kind of theoretical positions converged and reinforced each the sort of dug-in view of it.
Maybe one last question.
Tenny Gross, Institute for Nonviolence in Providence. I'm a former Israeli soldier, and I think there is sometimes an innocence that is hard to blow up. And which I think this book hopefully also will start to do for us. I think we have an image. I had an image of this country with its principles. I mean, my sister used to take me to the American Embassy as a kid, you know, borrow some music and Bob Dylan and books, etc. But this is an exceptionally violent country. We have per capita murder rate that was equivalent to Northern Ireland in the last 30 years. But they had an excuse for it. It was a civil war. We have 17,000 homicides a year. We have now more than a quarter of the people in jail in this country. And you allude to that connection. So, I work with gangs in this city and respond to the hospitals. I see the cruelty every day of our culture. You know, on MSNBC is entertainment at night, every night. We have a program from a jail. It's entertainment. I'm stunned. MSNBC. So, and you see the cynicism in the emergency room drivers, in cops. You wrote a book on a friend of mine, Andy Rosenzweig, who is one of the good cops, trying to really put community policing. But I think the erosion, we are in for a real introspection. Wall Street, what's happening now, there's a real time now for this country to do a serious retrospection. We're at a real moral hazard time. This is one, this is not a surprise to some of us.
Yeah, I do not. I mean, I think there are a lot of elements of the culture that found expression there. I mean, you know these things from working closely inside the worlds that this comes out of. And obviously part of the shock here was the, I mean, one of the strange things that I get asked about a lot with Abu Ghraib is the specific shock of, you know, why, okay, the people behave badly, the people do stupid things, the people do cruel things, that violence is an outlet and a cool thing and an easily accessible thing to tap into. But why would they do self-incriminating and stupid thing like taking pictures of themselves? I mean, I see two answers to that. One is that maybe they didn't think it was self-incriminating. Maybe they thought they were simply doing, as they say, documenting something that was allowed, that they didn't think that they were incriminating themselves. They weren't. They knew they were taking pictures of something wrong, but the same way you'd take pictures during battle. They're a kind of war story, like, whoa, look what we had to do over there in the war. And the other part is the photography gets at the element you're talking about when you get at the MSNBC. And I think, you know, we live in this time where digital photography, the sharing of images, the sharing, you know, you have, I think that there's a kind of mental surfing through images where you're like, look, a butterfly, look, a baby, look, those two people skipping down the beach, look, that guy getting his head cut off, look, that doggy walking down the street, look, that guy raping that girl, now crazy, look at that, man. And they're all sort of weirdly equal. They all just kind of flip by, and they're all cool images or powerful images. And the distinction and the sort of constant, the constant judgment of this constant barrage gets leveled. And I think that that is a place that's very hard to sort back through. And I think it breeds on itself. So I do think that there are a lot of kind of very large myths or notions or ideas we have about ourselves that kind of found themselves in conflict when you ride off to war. And I think it's particularly dramatized when it's not clear what you're there for. I mean, I think at every level, the breakdown here actually reflects a weakness in the purpose of the war. And so that these elements that you're talking about that are very real, that are available, that are but in normal domestic life are seen as criminal behaviors, are seen still as pathologies even if they're highly prevalent pathologies or pathologies that are more epidemic or endemic here than they may be in other societies. Nevertheless, they're seen that way, that those are given a freer rein when you don't know what you're fighting for. When you get over there and the evidence of the story you've been told and the way that this adventure has been billed to you, it actually unravels before your eyes. When the idea that we do things differently unravels before your eyes, when you know that everything is wrong and that you're not given any coherent orders and that everything seems, when you're in a realm of complete corruption and you're scared silly and in danger and have entrusted yourselves to people who are clearly treating your trust recklessly, I think that adds to it in a way that is really, really critical in trying to understand, I guess, one of the questions you asked from the beginning, which is sort of how do we get to a reckoning from it, which is in many ways, I think, what Tenney was asking at the end.
Yeah, it's your question, Philip. In the middle of the book, you kind of take stock and ask yourself, so what's the point? What's the use? Why vex your soul? What's the choice? And then you write, there is no keeping our hands clean of Abu Ghraib. Ignoring it doesn't work. Nor does denouncing it, and there's no disavowing it, never mind denying it. The stain is inescapable and irreversible, and it is ours. And if we have any hope of containing it and living it down, it can only come from seeing it whole. I like this question about, you know, Wall Street dissolving in front of our eyes. When do we, what will provoke us into the kind of introspection?
I don't know, but I mean, when I, that you asked sort of why write, well, you asked why write about it if I don't sort of have an activist wish to trigger consequences like people getting held to account. That'd be nice, but I don't, I'm under no illusions. I'm just a pen pusher. And, you know, this is really, I guess, the closest I came to trying to articulate in the book why I do it, which is one has to see this stuff whole. And I do think one can live past these things. I mean, you know, let's not forget that we've got a guy running for president right now who wouldn't have been allowed to vote more or less when he was born. And that's not insignificant. And it doesn't mean that that piece of history didn't happen. It doesn't mean that it's erased or anything else, but that changes can occur in which it becomes part of a different time. It becomes part of a different mindset. One can, that's what I mean by living it down and containing it. And I think it's important to say, that's why I say the stain is irreversible and like not indelible, and it is ours. But I also say in the next sentence, there is, if there's hope of living it down and containing it, because those two things are not mutually exclusive. It's not like you erase the stain. It's not like the stain goes away. But the stain acquires a place in the past, in history, in our consciousness, as something that has to some extent been contained and is no longer what we are. In this case, I do think that some of it involves a restoration of at least certain kinds of high principles. And high principles matter even when they're cynically violated. They do matter. It makes a difference what's sanctioned and what's not sanctioned. It makes a big, big difference, even if the behavior ends up the same. If you've got a guy beating a guy behind a building to get a confession out of him, and that's sanctioned as opposed to not sanctioned, it actually matters. Even not maybe to the guy getting beaten at that specific moment, but perhaps even to that guy when he gets past getting beaten and tries to get some redress and tries to get his story clarified and tries to have what happened to him. If the basic system says, sorry, that's okay. You know, like, so you got beaten. Shouldn't have gotten in that situation. What's the situation? That you got into a situation where you were being beaten. Maybe that's all you did wrong. And that, I think that's what I'm talking about when I say we need to start to figure out ways. And I'm a writer. I tell these stories about what's happened. But I try to think about, you know, where do we want to get to? We want to get to a very different place where some of this stuff is contained and actually belongs not so much to our immediate present. Isn't what we're looking at next year.
Philip Gurevich, thank you enormously for joining us on Open Source.
Thank you.
Paul McCarthy produced and edited this conversation. Please add your own thoughts on the torture questions at our website, www.radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for joining us.